This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. On today's programme, the indigenous Colombian peoples who are threatened with extinction as they're caught in the country's violent conflict. The eye hospital in northern India that's using football to get young girls interested in a medical career, and the new play that tells the stories of the wives and families of terrorism suspects who've been detained without trial. First, indigenous groups in Colombia are at risk of physical or cultural extinction, according to the country's constitutional court. They say 32 different groups could be wiped out as they're displaced from their land by the conflict in the country. The groups often find themselves caught between guerrilla factions, paramilitary groups and government forces who are battling for territory. According to campaigners, at least 1,400 indigenous people have been killed in the last 8 years. Well, two people who've experienced this threat at first hand are Luis Arias and Neda Rodriguez, who both campaign on behalf of indigenous people. Luis is a lawyer from the Canquamo group in the north of the country. Neda is from the Sicuani in the southeast of Colombia. They've been touring Europe in an attempt to raise awareness about the threats they face. When they came into the Outlook studio, Luis told me, through a translator, how the armed conflict is affecting his people.
Afecta fundamentalmente porque el conflicto en Colombia hoy se está desarrollando es en los territorios indígenas.
The conflict is developing so that it's spreading into the indigenous areas. Women, men and children alike have all become victims of the conflict. Women have been raped, children have been recruited into armed groups.
Why is the conflict spreading into the area where indigenous people live?
Porque la política de seguridad democrática.
It's a question of politics and economics. The indigenous areas have a great richness. There are incredible amounts of resources in terms of petrol, mineral rights and biodiversity. Nowadays, the indigenous populations are sitting on huge natural resources, and these are of interest to everyone involved in the conflict.
And are the indigenous people caught between the different armed groups?
Sí, en efecto, al ser nuestros territorios indígenas escenarios de guerra.
I believe there is a strategy of trying to bring civilian people, in this case indigenous populations, into the fight. And this is done by the guerrillas accusing us of being on the side of the army, and the army accusing us of being on the side of the guerrillas.
Neda, how has the armed conflict affected you personally? Do you know people who have been killed or hurt?
En el resguardo, sí nos han afectado porque.
In the indigenous territory where me and my family live, armed groups have come in and taken young people, men and women, away to fight. In 1999, that was the first time the guerrillas came, and we didn't really know what guerrillas were and what they wanted, and everyone was very scared and everyone hid. And it was even more frightening because very few people understood Spanish at the time, so we didn't know what they were saying.
Luis, have you a personal experience of the kind of violence that's been happening in your area?
En varias oportunidades. Mi abuelo.
At various times, my grandfather and my uncle, they were both assassinated by paramilitary groups. The first on the 4th of August 2001 and the second on the 3rd of August 2004. On both of those occasions, I was with my grandfather and my uncle when they were assassinated.
Después del asesinato de mi tío.
After the death of my uncle, I had to move to Bogotá and I was receiving death threats. And then in April 2008, two people on motorbikes turned up at the house where I used to live, asking for me by name.
What happened?
Afortunadamente no estaba en la casa. Solamente estaba la dueña.
Luckily, I wasn't in the house at that time. The maid was in the house and she called me to let me know that there had been people there with machine guns and she warned me.
And do you think you were targeted because you have been speaking out for the rights of indigenous people?
Mi tío, que asesinaron, nos dijo alguna vez.
My uncle, who was assassinated, told us once. We were all together in a room to try to decide what we could do because we were being targeted. And my uncle said, if they are killing us when we have our mouth shut, then we may as well have them kill us when we are talking. From that point, I began trying to tell all the world what is happening to us indigenous people, My uncle may be dead, but I'm still following his example.
Neda, I wonder if I can ask about how difficult life is for the peoples in the area you come from. You've said that there are now 9 indigenous groups living together. Is there enough land for those groups all to live together, or is that making life very difficult?
No, no hay tierra para eso. Ya hemos crecido bastante.
There's no enough land, no. And we keep growing in size. There are now about 3,200 of us living there. Now we don't really have the freedom to live and go to other areas. We can't even raise enough food to feed ourselves on that small piece of land. It's not good for growing things in anymore. And it's very difficult for us, indigenous people, because we are nomads. We want to hold on to our land, but we need to move around to find food.
Do some people give up and go to live in the big cities?
Sí, sí, y este año, comienzo de año, se nos han ido...
Yes, yes. This year alone, 3 of the families have been displaced from their land and so have gone to Puerto Carreno, the regional capital. They find whatever work they can, so they clean houses, they sometimes wash clothes. The women do that.
Luis, do you worry that whole indigenous peoples will simply disappear, that they will no longer have their unique identity?
Sí, claro. Ahí nosotros hemos identificado que por lo menos 32...
Yes, of course. We have identified 32 indigenous groups in Colombia, which are now a threat. They are on the edge of complete extinction, culturally and language-wise.
And what can be done to stop that happening?
Varias cosas. Primero, queremos sensibilizar...
Various things. The first thing we can do is to raise awareness of what is going on. The situation of the indigenous people in Colombia is as serious as it is invisible, and sometimes it's deliberately kept hidden. We want to ask for help from the international community and from international and multilateral organizations and the world in general to help the Colombian state adopt efficient, effective means of protection for these people. I want to take advantage of the fact these microphones are here to send a message to everyone in the world. The disappearance of indigenous people in Colombia is the disappearance of an entire world.
What about the authorities in Colombia? Can they not do something to save the groups that are under threat?
Bueno, hasta ahora, los esfuerzos...
Up until now, the only thing the Colombian state has done is made declaration and release pamphlets. The Colombian Constitutional Court has condemned what the Colombian state has done, saying that it's been nothing but formal measures. It's been insufficient, lacking in focus.
And, Neda, in the meantime, do people get more and more frustrated, angry, frightened?
Pues, algunos estamos con miedo.
Some of us are afraid and some of us aren't. Some people just don't understand the situation, but this is part of the fight, that we're trying to help the people understand what's going on.
Neda Rodriguez and Luis Arias on their campaign on behalf of the indigenous people of Colombia. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Coming later in the programme, the new play that tells the stories of the wives of terrorism suspects who've been detained without trial in Britain and the USA. But now, the villagers of Mustichak in the conservative northern Indian state of Bihar are having to get used to a strange sight. Young girls playing football at the local eye hospital. Inspired by the film Bend It Like Beckham, many of the girls dream of becoming professional players. But when they're not training on the pitch, they're also getting an education. And it's hoped that some at least will resist the glamour of football to follow a career in optometry. It's a skill which is much in demand in an area where thousands suffer from blindness and cataracts. Our reporter Nivedita Patak went to see the girls in training.
Braving the chill of the wintry morning, girls in and around the rural village of Mustichak descend on the football ground to practice 5 days a week. In Bihar's traditional society, girls generally cover themselves. So to see these girls playing football in shorts is genuinely surprising. This football team started with just 2 girls casually kicking a ball around, but has now grown to a squad of nearly 70 girls. Mrityunjay Tiwari is the man behind the team, and he tells me about how he has had to battle deeply rooted traditions to get this far.
people are very conservative and they didn't want girls or women to actually work or come out of their houses. But it was a chance event and suddenly I saw two small girls kicking around a ball in shorts. And that was a sight which, I think it has changed the whole scenario here. I walked up to them and asked them how they are playing. They said that we are just hiding and playing some of the balls which the boys who used to play on the field left over. That is when it struck me that let's take this one issue and hit out at all the anomalies which the society in rural Bihar puts up. So going around the schools, I was surprised that every class had around 8 or 10 girls who were interested. And when you peep inside the girls' school, you will find that there were some girls who were kicking around balls made of paper. So that in itself showed that the interest, inherent desire was there, but the society was made in such a fashion that they couldn't express themselves.
12-year-old Chandani is one such girl. She practices hard every day as she wants to realize her dream of being a professional player instead of just preparing for married life.
Meri mummy bolti hai ki main abhi apne beti ko khilaungi.
Actually, I've been playing football for 9 to 10 months. I don't want to get married like my friend, whose parents got her married just some time back. My parents want me to play well. The boys tease us girls for playing football, as they keep telling us that girls are supposed to work at home, but I don't care about them. I love playing football and my skills have become better. And I want to be a professional football player.
The girls on the team are all aged 11 to 19 years. It was a difficult task to get parents to agree to let their daughters play football. Mritunjay had to think of something which could persuade parents to allow their daughters to come to the football ground.
The trade-off was, I'll take care of the education part and I will train them up and give them jobs at the hospital. More importantly, give them a graduation in optometry which ensures that they land up a job minimum of rupees 10,000 per month, around $250.
I am 15 years old and my parents wanted to get me married. When I objected, they told me that everyone gets married at this age, so why shouldn't I?
Now dressed in blue shorts and a jersey, Sushma could so easily have been one of the thousands of girls who are forced into the tradition of early marriage. Before she joined the team, her parents had already arranged for her to get married. But timely intervention by Mritunjay changed the course of her life.
Most of my friends are already married, so I had no option. But then Mritunjay sir approached my parents and coaxed them to let me play football and study further. I am in 10th grade and want to be a good professional player. But if I don't manage to achieve that, I would like to get a government job and become independent. Today, things have changed at home. My parents are also now very happy about the decision and want to let me carry on with my plans.
Playing football is not the only plan for their future. Mritunjay runs a charitable hospital where 24,000 eye surgeries are performed a year. In the rural areas where there's a shortage of trained medical staff, he has plans to secure both the future careers of these girls and the future of rural medical care.
Bihar is one state which has a huge backlog of blindness. Almost 1 million people are blind and there's 100,000 join them every year. To do 100,000 surgeries, to reach that, we need manpower. And the girls, when we saw the passion with which they play, it struck as the ideal center whereby we can channel them off to the hospital. Over a period of 5 years, they will become the future nurses and the paramedical staff for this hospital.
To achieve this goal, Mritunjay has realized that besides having a healthy body and mind, these girls need to be trained in information technology and English, as this will give them the tools they need to graduate in optometry.
Mritunjay's teaching these girls English and has asked them to write school, word school on the board.
Madhu, the youngest of the lot. She's too excited actually.
Well done. That's the correct spelling.
The education system here in Bihar is not strong enough. If I don't train them up in English and computers for 4 years, they'll not be able to go through that optometry course. So that's very mandatory. And 75% of them had never seen a computer at all. A lot of them, their hands trembled for the first time when they touched the system.
After a day of hard practice, these girls board the bus and are singing a song of a better future. A start has been made. But the team still has a long way to go to prove to others that given the right opportunities, these shy girls in their shorts and jerseys can change their own destiny.
The girls of the Akhan Jayoti Eye Hospital football team with our reporter Nivedita Patak in Bihar in northern India. Now, there's been much media coverage of the cases of terrorism suspects detained without trial in both the US and the UK. The American detention centre at Guantanamo Bay has attracted criticism, and in Britain, suspects have been controversially held at the high-security Belmarsh prison. But much less attention has been paid to the effects of this detention on the suspects' wives and families. That's why the British journalist Victoria Britton has decided to write a musical play based on the testimonies of five women whose husbands have been held without trial. The women are all now British citizens who either came to the UK as refugees or, in the case of one, married a refugee. They come from the Palestinian Territory, Jordan, Senegal and the East Midlands of England, but their experiences of confusion and isolation are very similar. When Victoria came to the Outlook studio, I asked how she got to know these women.
I was previously involved in a play about Guantanamo called Guantanamo, Honour Bound to Defend Freedom, which was about the families of men living in Britain who were detained in Guantanamo Bay. And we use both letters from the people in Guantanamo and the interviews with their families. And what struck me after that was that in none of the places did we see any women. And there were a couple of families who had not even agreed to take part. And I wrote to them to say, you know, now we've done this play, I have some appreciation of what happened to your husband, and I want to say I'm really sorry. And one of them immediately rang me up, although her English was terrible, and said, come and visit me. So I became very friendly with her. And in visiting her and becoming friendly with her children and so on, I began to meet other Muslim women whose husbands were detained in Belmarsh. And there was a group of 12 Muslims who were detained here.
And Belmarsh is a UK prison.
In high security UK prison as a group. And they were taken in December 2001, obviously as a result of 9/11. And so I gradually began to hear these stories. And I became very friendly with some of them, particularly the most isolated ones, because one of the things that happened was that people from their own communities were afraid to visit them because they thought either the husband is a terrorist, in which case I don't want to go there, or even more frightening, perhaps he's not a terrorist, in which case if I get involved, my husband might be taken.
So these women were very much alone. And was it the case that in the first instance, many of them didn't really understand what was happening to their husbands?
No. I mean, I think that's kind of what comes out of this play as a theme, that neither they nor their husbands had a clue what it was all about. And it's very striking that each character at a different time says, do you know, nobody ever questioned him while he was held by the British in prison. And the feeling of total confusion wherever they turned, there were no answers.
And did they mind that you might turn all this into either a piece of journalism or, as it turned out, a drama?
Well, I absolutely hadn't intended to. And in fact, it was the lawyers who suggested to me that I should write another play, but about their husbands. And I said jokingly to one of the women, I'm definitely not going to do that. And she said, well, why don't you write about me? So I thought about it and I tried it out on two or three of them, and each one said, yeah, I really want to do it. And then they started ringing up their friends and saying, do you want to do it too? And so it really was a communal endeavour, and they all saw my version of them, and every single word is their words.
So you took what they said and transcribed it effectively?
Yes. And what was so warming about seeing the play put on, to which all the women came, except for the one who's in Jordan. And all of them were kind of saying to each other, it was me. It was my voice. And a couple of the husbands said to me too, I'm so proud of my wife. I hear her voice. They didn't come to the play, but they read it beforehand.
Now, you've mentioned the husband's reaction as well. Some of them were released, but that wasn't the end of the problem, was it? Because some of them were released under conditions of security, which must have meant that there were other
pressures on the families?
Those who were released from British prisons were put on control orders, which is a kind of house arrest with very strict conditions. They have an electronic tag on their legs. They have a specific area that they can go to near their house, and they have a time limit. Sometimes it's like 2 hours or sometimes it's 3 hours. And that's a big stress because, as one of them says in the play, we know many people who did go back to Belmarsh because they breached the control order. And the police also can visit them at any time and search anywhere in the house for anything. So they found this house arrest, and some of them are still on it, has put them in very serious depression. And there are three of the characters in the play who have watched their husbands either try to kill themselves or become so deranged that they've had to be in mental hospitals. So this shows you, out of such a small number, so many can be so mentally destroyed.
Now, what about the guilt or innocence of the men involved? I mean, presumably you formed a view about that, because the authorities would say that they've done this because these people are suspicious, they're people who might be a danger to society. Presumably you disagree with that.
I do disagree with that, because I know that if there was anything against any of these people, they would have loved to put them into court. And the fact that there was nothing, and after all these years, both the ones in Guantanamo who've come back and the ones who've been detained here, the only court hearings that they've ever been have always been with the evidence held in secret. And I think that's wrong.
But the argument is usually that in order to display that in public, they would have to jeopardise the sources of the information, jeopardise people in the security services.
That is the security service objection. But I think there are many people who now realise that when the security services say somebody is dangerous and we can't tell you why, I think many more people are sceptical now than they would have been before.
And what was your view? You met these people, obviously. You met their wives. You met them in person. Did you form a view about their guilt or innocence?
Well, I very early on formed a view that they were completely innocent of anything.
And it would have put huge pressure on any kind of relationship to have to go through these things. Did any of them ever consider leaving the relationships?
No, because another aspect of their morality is a fierce loyalty, and a fierce loyalty to their husbands when they knew the injustice that their husbands were suffering. I think they would walk through fire for them.
Victoria Britton, author of the play Waiting. Don't forget to visit our website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook. But that's all for today. I'm Matthew Bannister. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow with another edition of Outlook. Do join me then.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.